Going.
Okay, the time is 3:03 on October 2nd, 2023, and I'm convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Audit Committee of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on September 21st, 2023, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official meeting minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved since all three members are present. Also in attendance is Board Counsel Shelby Batts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, our Chief Director, Executive Director, pardon me, Bart Bowles, Jared Terry, and Topping Haggerty from the Association. From TDI, we have Brian Ree and Sean, I didn't catch the last name.
Martin.
Sean Martin from TDI. The first item on the agenda is the consent agenda, which is the minutes of the April 4th meeting. Did everyone have a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes.
Is there a motion?
Mark Williams, move that we accept the minutes as written.
And
Thank
Patty
you, Mark.
Seconds.
We have a motion from Mark, second from Patty. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, next item is consideration of possible action regarding the scope of the audit of the financial statements.
Dean, if I could just for a little background on this, each year we do ask the audit committee if they have any additional operational matters they would like to have reviewed. And we used to do this as an agreed upon procedure or agreed upon procedure engagement with the audit. The way the audit procedures have changed over the years, they have been separate. Consulting engagements, but they've been conducted usually by the audit firm at the same time the audit's conducted. The two most recent reviews in 2006, the committee had the auditor look at the in-house claims adjudication. We had a lot of in-house business being administered at that time, and a good portion of it was major medical business. And then in 2017, the board had entered into a consulting agreement to look at the internal controls for cash receipts, cash disbursements, and investment transactions. And from both of those, there were no adjustments to any procedures or any control matters. So we had told the audit committee back in April that we were going to look at the volume of claims activity. And what we have seen is the blocks of business we're administering in-house are just not a lot of volume. Even the Calanthe Mutual, there's not a lot of claims activity. And we would prefer that if you're going to do any type of additional review, you get your bang for your buck. We do have some matters coming up in Friday that are going to require that we do some direct in-house payments instead of funding through the TPA and the outside payment vendor. So we do think by this time next year, there will be a substantial larger volume of claims. And we recommend that you consider doing a review of the in-house claims adjudication and external claims control and monitoring, but not at this time. So I'm open for questions or comments on that.
Hey, Bart, this is Patty. That sounds reasonable to me. So it would be end up being a 2024 mid-year later kind of audit, or the end of 2024, just because the Friday will be so much more volume than what
and,
we've
and
had.
We would go back.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We would pick up several years of review. Plus, with some of the additional insolvencies nationally, we have the auditors could look at the process we use to review claims batches, what testing we do, how we fund them. They could look at that entire process, not only in-house, but also what we do on externally processed blocks of business.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd hate to pay for an audit when there's not a whole lot to actually look into. I know with Friday and some of these are some exceptional circumstances, and I think that's a great time to have someone audit your internal controls and make sure everything you're doing, you know, holds up. So I think next year is an excellent idea.
Okay. Any other areas you think we need to expand the scope of the audit, or, I mean, they're doing a full audit, so anyway.
They're doing a full audit. It's just if there was any specific areas that you wanted them consider a consulting agreement to dig in a little deeper. We were just thinking because we're doing in-house business now and we're doing a lot more of claims funding externally. Beyond that, there's really no operational changes that might require review.
And let me just remind the committee that the auditor issues an opinion on the fairness of the financial statements. They do not issue an opinion on the internal controls. They do review the internal controls, but their opinion is on the financial statements. So if there's any additional internal controls that you would like them to look at, this would be where that would take place.
And Dean, that's all we have.
I still think that it'd be better next year when the activity picks up to look over internal controls, if that would be the time to look at the controls over payment processing.
Okay.
Because that, what do you, how many checks do you write a month?
Maybe 20 to 30.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you look at sample size, that's not a lot of sample size to choose from.
Okay, let's move on to item three, consideration and possible action regarding recommending the engagement of the independent auditor for the upcoming audit of the financial statements for the year ended December 31, 2023. Do we need to go into executive session on this?
Well, we need to, if you allow me to make a few preparatory comments in open session and then tell you why we're going to do a little discussion in executive session. That's all right.
Sure.
Just to remind the committee that there is a section of the administrative code that does require that the association cannot use the same CPA to do the financial audit more than 7 consecutive years. And you can see in this table that Jarrett assembled, these are the years that we've used Clifton Larson Allen, the firm, to do the audit. And you can see above the bold line are the 7 years where Jerry McMillan was the audit partner. Below that are the years where Bhakti Patel was the audit partner. Now, of course, prior to 2012, we had 2 other audit, different firms we had used in the history of the Association of Due Reviews. We just wanted to give you the history of Clifton Larson Allen here. So Bhakti Patel has performed as the audit partner 4 years for the association. So there's not a requirement to change auditor. And after the committee's review of performance of the auditor and the thoroughness and how they did the, how they conducted the audit and their interchange with the association staff. There was not a desire to do an RFP. So we did solicit and received a new engagement proposal from Bhakti. That was distributed confidentially through the board portal to the committee members for their review. There were a couple of items that Jarrett prepared a separate memo to explain. If you'll look at the very last line where Jarrett has shaded the current engagement proposal, you will see there's about a 15% increase in fees. And Jarrett did some analysis of what drove that increase in fees. We would like to discuss that in executive session with you and review that memo and ask you to not take any action on this engagement proposal until we have that discussion.
Council, either Shelby or Jackie, remind me why this is executive session.
Well, I think because you're going to be deliberating on this proposal and the fact that it is so much higher, I do think it's okay to say in open session, just sort of generally, what things that have changed that in part make the fee higher than before, as opposed and not going into all of the analysis that Jarrett has done to look into those things.
Yeah, I would say, yeah,
I don't know why. Go ahead.
When we get into the specifics of the items we identified that caused the increase in fee, that is a little more of a competitive discussion, and I don't want to provide a competitive advantage to any firm by providing insight into the pricing of how one firm establishes their fees.
But I think you can go ahead and say that at least part of the reason the fees are higher are there are changes in accounting standards or auditing standards or however you want to describe them that require more work.
Yes.
And more things that have to be looked at. And so I think you can discuss those things more fully in executive session. And I will note, Bart, that, you know, in this context, we don't actually have any other bidders.
Right.
So we don't have any other bidders to really be concerned about. If your concern is, you know, perhaps looking forward to future years where we would have other bidders, I mean, I think they would have to be mindful of these new requirements as well.
Right.
So you're comfortable with this being an executive session item?
I am.
I was just going to add that when you look at the agenda and it under the executive session, it talks about advice of counsel. There's not really, as you know, the presumption under the Open Meetings Act is everything's supposed to be an open session unless it is subject matter that's described in one of the exemptions in the act. And exemption pertaining to advice of counsel, you know, it talks specifically about litigation and a settlement proposal and anything else that under the Texas Code of Professional Conduct applicable to attorneys, essentially requires the attorney to keep protected or confidential. So I think some subject matter may come up, which, since attorneys are, you have your two counsel here who can give legal advice, and you don't want to do that in open session because it would compromise the confidentiality of that. I don't think there's a general exemption for contract negotiations or that sort of thing.
Right.
But I do think you can invoke the exemption that's noted on the notice of the meeting.
And that's good advice from counsel.
Yes.
Okay. Then the time is 3:16 on October 2nd.
Dean?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Before you go to executive session, let's talk about the network penetration test, because portion of that is going to be discussed in executive session as well.
Okay.
Okay. So if you don't mind, I'll just roll into it. Jarrett prepared an RFP and distributed it, and it followed the format of prior year's RFP when we're looking for a firm to perform network penetration and social engineering testing. And of course, that includes what we call email phishing. And there's a lot to it. And this field is so expanding. When you get proposals back from firms, it's not quite an apples to apples comparison. It's very difficult to compare. So I thought I would take just a moment and tell you how I look at these firms and how Jarrett and I review them, how we try to evaluate them. And it's more than dollars. And we do look at a number of factors, including were they responsive to the RFP for the things we asked that they provide? And did it appear that they paid attention to the structure of the IT and network environment that we provided to them? The second thing we look at, do they provide a thorough explanation of the different testing they provide, network penetration, social engineering? Is it gray box? Is it black box? Does it use NIST standards? There's a long list if you get into how they would perform it, how many hours would be dedicated to it, and how many addresses they test. This is a very difficult thing to compare because it goes on and on and on, but we do read through each one of them in detail. What are their credentials and experience of the firm? What kind of certifications do they hold? Are they experienced? What is the association's experience with them? Have we used any of these firms before? Then we also look at the team that would be dedicated to evaluate and do the work, their adherence with the timeline. Can they meet the timeline requirements to perform and provide a report and remediation recommendations? And the last thing, although it's not the last on the list, as you prioritize them, it's just the last on my list of factors, are the fees. And there was a significant range here in fees, and I'll talk about those in detail in executive session. And Dean, this was a request for proposal, a competitive bidding process, and I believe that talking about the specific names of firms and associating elements of their proposal and their fees must be maintained confidential until the association's board of directors has actually adopted and engaged a firm. Is that correct, Jackie?
It is. And I think what Bart is getting to is the six proposals, instead of discussing them by name in open session, Jarrett has assigned numbers to each one of them. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Actually, letters. A, B,
oh, letters.
C, D, E, F. Yeah.
So assigned letters to them. And then it will not be, and then, you know, we can, the identities will be disclosed in the executive session. And then the recommendation that the committee makes, assuming they do, to the board would be the alphabetical identification of the recommended vendor.
And if the board or the committee does make a recommendation to the board, the resolution will contain the letter of the firm as presented by staff rather than the name of the firm. So I think the last thing I can say, now that I've mentioned the factors we're going to look at, I can say the range of fees from high to low without naming any firms. We did have one firm that proposed $6,088 to do this work. That was a low. Up to one was $17,500. So it was a pretty substantial difference in fees to do this. And there also were differences in the expectations on the timing and the payment of those fees. So as we talk about some of the proposals in executive session, we'll be sure to point out a couple of key factors.
Can you say, Bart, generally, whether the proposals covered the same kinds of things, or was there a lot of difference in what the proposed work was?
They covered the same categories of testing. The techniques for about half of them were very similar. Some of the other ones have different techniques to do it. Some of the proposals were specific and referenced some of the elements that we provided, number of IP addresses, the number of users, things like that. Others appeared to be a boilerplate proposal that here's what we do on all network penetration and social engineering testing. And for this firm, this is the fees we're going to charge. So it didn't have, there were several that did not have that level of specificity in line with what the association was requesting and the association structure.
Hey, Bart, can I ask a question? I can't remember how we got the name. Did we reach out to particular firms that we had gotten referrals about, or did we, or did they just, we post that we were interested in these happen to be the ones that bid? I can't remember how we selected the ones that we're about, that we're comparing right now.
Jarrett, why don't you describe that?
So it's a little bit of both. We've kind of gathered a list of these firms through recommendations from Nolga, from some of the board members, and just some general online searching. And we just continue to add, or let's say adjust that list each time we do this RFP. This year, we actually added someone who reached out to us and asked if they could bid. Actually, there were two this year that reached out to us and asked if they could bid on any kind of network penetration test. So we just keep that list and then roll it forward each time we do the RFP.
No, Patty,
thanks, Jared. That's helpful. Thanks, sure. Bart.
One thing we try to do, Patty, is stay in touch with our other guarantee associations that are performing network penetration tests. Hey, how did it go? Were you happy with the firm? Did they did a quality review? Where are they located? Or did they do work nationally? Could we put them on our list? So we try to keep expanding our list pretty carefully. You know, the firms that do this, there are hundreds and hundreds. There's just a lot of firms that do this. I think the six that we got proposals from are all very much good quality firms.
That's great. Thanks, Bart.
And I will say there are a couple that's on our list that just won't submit a proposal. Either we're too small, or they just won't take the time to do it because we're not big enough for them.
Yeah, I think, Jarrett, how many did this RFP go out to? Was it about a dozen?
Nine. We sent it out to nine. We had taken a couple off the list from last time because they asked us not to send them anymore.
So Dean, that's all in open session. I want to summarize about the testing RFP process.
So are we ready to go to executive session?
No, we have one more item. Just in case this item has questions raised that council may need to address. So we're trying to put everything before executive session. We can do executive session one time and address all your concerns. Item 5, Dean, I'll put on screen here. It's this write-off of certain, these are assessment receivables and payables. And I'm going to add some things, but I'm going to ask Jarrett to discuss this, if that's all right, Gene, Dean.
Yeah, what's the statute of limitations on this?
There's really not a statute of limitations on this. So this kind of all kicked off with a discussion with the auditor last year. Bart, can you scroll down to page 5-3? So there at the top in that first note, there highlighted in yellow, is a little note on our financial statements that includes all these balances. And the question from the auditor was, or the note from the auditor was, maybe you shouldn't include these allowances in that number if it's not recoverable. And she's, you know, no one has said anything about you shouldn't carry the balances on your balance sheet. It's just should you probably shouldn't note that on this financial statement, which led to, excuse me, which led to Bart and I having a discussion on maybe we should just go ahead and write these off. So after the audit, and part of this year, we started doing some research into, let's see if we can find any way to identify who these are, if there's any way to collect them, or if there's anything, any information we can find on this before we resort to writing them off. We looked through everything we had and cannot find the information that we need to identify these actual balances and who they belong to. So we have no way of sending these member companies an invoice to collect these receivables. Now, like I said, the impact of the receivables to the financial statements is zero because they are fully reserved. But the cleanest thing would be to just go ahead and write this off. So I talked to Bhakti, our CPA, about this, and she actually encouraged, yeah, go ahead and write them off. There's nothing there. we talked about the methodology for writing them off, and there will be no impact to the financial statements on this other than that note there highlighted in yellow would be eliminated because these balances are no longer there. So that's the assessment receivable and allowances. Were there any questions on that?
Let's back up and describe. You know, the composition of that, the receivable amount and the allowance, you can see these go all the way back to October of 1995. And Shelby, you'll remember the deferral from, was that 1996? And Jarrett, we looked at that. Is that, we discussed that?
Yeah, we haven't talked about the deferral yet.
The deferral balances. Yeah. But what it is we've been trying to find the details on these from the 1995 assessment receivable, what was not paid. And we just can't find the records anywhere. And it goes all the way up through from 1995 through 2005. So these actually predate Jarrett. And I don't know if you guys were aware, I was definitely in the association involved at that time, but I was specifically excluded from assessment activities. I did not participate in assessment work. So I don't know how these records were maintained. We did go through a couple of conversions of accounting systems. My suspicion is a lot of these balances were detailed in Excel spreadsheets that we just don't have anywhere. And we did a lot of digging and try to find these to try to see who are the companies, what are the companies that are involved, and why was it not collectible. I do know that the practice of every year going in there and trying to ask the TDI to assist in the collection of outstanding assessments, We've been much more thorough with that in the last decade, decade and a half. Back in these days, some of these may have been receivables from insolvent companies that should not have been assessed. They may have been companies that requested deferrals or some type of exception to their balance. But I can't say definitively because I can't find records.
And I'm going to say, I think the records weren't in spreadsheets. I think they were on paper copy and have since been destroyed.
So this is kind of like one of the last cleanup, I guess we call them antiquated messes that we were trying to clean up from balances and amounts in our financials that just carry over year to year to year. It's time to just step up and address them and put them to bed. And as Jarrett said, you can see these numbers if you take the receivable less the allowance. And let me skip over the deferral. Is this the net effect right here, Jarrett?
Yes, that would be that would be changed. So that would be the number that resulted if we made this adjustment. So the deferrals and the reallocation is a little different than the assessment of receivable balances. They're still treated as a receivable and an allowance on those, but that was a little bit, I think, a kind of one-off situation. I'm not real familiar with that. Bart, do you have more information on that 96 deferral and reallocation? I think there was a premium limitation issue on that.
Well, the statute does have a limitation that no company can be assessed more than, I think at that time, Jackie, it was a 1% limit.
1%, yeah.
Now. And because of that, not all companies could be assessed their entire Class B assessment because it would exceed 1% of the premiums being used to calculate that assessment, the 1994 premiums. So the excess amount was deferred and said this will be collected in future assessments when that company's payment would not exceed their 1% limitation. And for years, there had been a trickle of funds collecting on some of these. Now, initially, it was a larger number, but I think in the next year, most of it was paid. And then over some years, there were companies that just never had enough capacity or never had an assessment amount due. Some of them even left the market. There was no way to collect these things. And so that deferral amount has been sitting out there forever. And I think, Jarrett, since you've been with the association and is today, what, your 16th year?
16, yes.
Yeah, 16 years today. As of today, Jarrett's been with the association. We've never collected any deferral amounts in those 16 years. I want to say it's been closer to 20 years.
Yeah, we don't, once again, we don't have the records to determine who actually owes those deferrals. Or we would have collected as much as we can, but Bart makes a good point. There's a high likelihood that these are ones that you just can't collect for one reason or another.
Now you might say, well, this comes up again, what are we going to do? A couple of things have changed. First, the statute's changed. We now have a 2% limit annually. We, as a matter of operational practice, manage our capacity a little bit differently. We try to structure our payments on our obligations through agreements and other timings that we don't need that much money at any one time. And if we need to assess, can we spread out those assessments over several years? So it's a little bit of enhanced assessment capacity management. And then we haven't had any substantial runs. I will say that there is a two companies brewing out there that are going to create a capacity crunch for a couple of states. And I'm going to be actually one of the presenters in a town hall call of NOLGA coming up in the next week and a half to help guaranty associations manage their capacity and how to use the authorize and call language in the statute to grab capacity so they can meet those obligations. Because we do think when these companies finally enter liquidation, there's going to be about a $2.5 billion payment by the system. It's not going to be an issue for us because we have plenty of room, but for at least five states, the amount that's going to come due for them is going to stretch their capacity abilities. So that's a long-winded way to talk about deferral and reallocation. It was I'll call it almost a one-off issue from 1996, hasn't come up since. And we think with the change in law and the change in how we manage assessments, we don't think it will happen again. Problem is, we can't assess what we're carrying as a remaining deferral. And Jarrett, the deferral balance is what, 189,000?
Yeah, well, life, yeah, 189,000 for life, and then 582,000 for, or 583,000 for annuity. And then the offsetting reallocation is the 129 and the 572. So net, it would be an impact of $69,914 to the balance sheet. If you go back down to page 5.3, you'll see that number, that 74,000, the one in blue, will change to $4,475. And that amount there is actually a true deferral. We have one company that every time we assess, they ask for a deferral of their assessment because they are running off the business and usually the board grants it. So we actually are carrying that as a deferral because at some point we may actually be able to collect that when they wind down that estate.
Now, this company is in rehab and they ask for it every year. It's granted and they have no intention of going back into the marketplace. They were just doing a runoff of a block of business. And should they, when they get to the end of that runoff, if they have assets remaining, they may be able to pay a portion or all of the deferrals. And it's not just in Texas, in all the states where they're licensed and they get assessments. They've requested and been granted deferrals in all those states. It allows the company to run off and meet its obligations without triggering a liquidation. So it's not impacting the marketplace, and it's not in any way harming other companies. It just promotes an orderly dissolution of a company. So, Dean, this is a little bit of a unique item that the committee's not seen before, but what we'd ask, we have a resolution for you to consider. But we put this before executive session. If you have any questions of counsel before taking action of it, we could address those questions in executive session.
Well, if we don't know who they are, we really don't have much of a chance of collecting it.
No.
You know, Bart... I'm convinced you don't have the records, but when you make, the numbers sound big enough that it's, we don't want this to happen again. Is there, can you put in the resolution some kind of whereas clause that, or, document in some fashion that the record keeping that the association does today, this would not happen again.
Can we put something in, Jackie, you might think about this, whereas we're based on the enhanced record keeping, improved assessment management, and change in association statute, it's not anticipated that this event would ever be repeated or something like that.
Yeah. Or just, I mean, I, a whereas documentation regarding these amounts does not exist, and whereas that prevents figuring it out. I mean, I guess it'll take a while I don't know exactly how to read it, but I guess if I were a board member, I would want some comfort that, hey, this happened in the misty past, and you know, we just don't have the records for it, but not to worry going forward. We have better record keeping now, I hope.
let me put counsel on spot there, Ms. Rickson. Do you want to think about a couple of whereases between now and the end of the executive session, maybe an executive session? I could even put it up on screen and we can see, are we comfortable with these things?
Yes, I can do that.
Well, don't you think that's, I mean.
Oh, it definitely improves the action. I like the record that this was unique, and because of certain factors, we don't anticipate this will happen again.
Yeah.
It should be captured.
Yeah.
Well, I assume there's like your record, you know, you have a record retention policy, but you don't destroy records that are essential to backing up entries in current financial statements.
Well, the one thing we do, well, two things we have now is with our electronic document management system, the records we keep. And one of those areas is on assessments. Every company has a folder within our electronic record keeping. Any action taken on those companies, any correspondence in them, any inquiries, we have every record on that. Plus, for each assessment, we have detailed summaries in that electronic storage facility for everything associated with that assessment. And then the third thing, now that in the ZAC assessment system, we are enhancing and have been for a couple of years, the records that are maintained there. So there's some redundancy that we have these detailed records, not handwritten or not just in a spreadsheet. They are retained in a couple of different electronic facilities.
Yeah, maybe the approach should be, think about this, Jackie, it's just kind of a cursory resolved due to insufficient documentation for decades old transactions. The board authorizes this write-off, and just have a further resolved and further resolved, the association shall maintain appropriate and adequate record keeping for all entries in its financial statements. I'm not wedded to any words, but it's just the concept that I think when you make a correction like that, you want to have comfort that it's not going to happen again, and that you've thought about it and what went wrong, and it was you've addressed the situation.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And, you know, I do remember, like, at that time, as Bart and Jarrett were saying, you know, the assessments, it was something that it was not nearly as sophisticated as assessments are now. And I do remember lots and lots of Excel spreadsheets being involved. And, you know, it's easy for me to see how that information was not captured as well as it should have been going forward. And the other thing that we also, you know, probably don't have captured is how much of those deferred assessments were actually recovered.
Right.
Because in subsequent years, those companies that had a deferral, they would have been assessed. And if they still had extra capacity, then they would pay, you know, their portion of their deferral back. And so for some reason, we ended up with this universe of companies that, you know, were either, for whatever reason, they were never able to pay that deferral back. And now we don't know who they are and how much their deferral was for. So, okay, well, I'll take a
Bart, can I ask
Yes, Patty.
Can I ask a quick question? I just want to make sure. And these are so old. On future ones in this situation, or since 05 or whenever the last one was, do we have a? Wouldn't it be prudent after 7 years or after a period of time to write them off routinely? I mean, I'm trying to understand. I can understand now how we don't lose track and we know where the company is and what the legal entity is. But I'm still wondering if we need some kind of policy about if something sits on the book longer than, isn't there some industry standard of it's been on the books for X number of years?
There's not a
well,
and write it off if it's an extended period of time.
Go ahead, Jarrett.
Okay, so really, what this boils down to is collectability. If it's ever deemed collectible or uncollectible, then you should write it off. If you continue to believe that the receivable is collectible, then you continue to carry it on your books.
And so this is just another of the cleanup items we've been working on of balances in the association's financials. We still have one other that we're going to be working on, and those are the funds that we're holding from credit refunds that balances are being held, and we are in process of researching those to see how many of those companies, and we do have the details on that company by company, who has these credit balances for the underlying assessments. Have they taken all their premium tax offsets? So are they entitled to those funds? Now that balance is what, Jarrett? 4.8 million, something like that.
I think it's right around 4 million. Yeah.
4 million. It's not as much money, but it's very detailed research. So I don't want you to think that this cleanup is the last. We still have one more we're working on. But Dean, on this, if we could give Jackie a minute to do some drafting, we can move into executive session and have our discussion. Look at the language on screen there, see if everyone's comfortable with it. And then we come out of executive session, we'll have three things to address.
Okay, so we're ready for executive session?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the time is 3:52 on October 2nd, 2023. I am recessing the regular session of the Audit Committee meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the committee to meet in executive session pursuant to the Open Meetings Act. Topping, tell me when when we're in executive session.
All right, thank you.
We are back in public session.
Okay, the time is 4:22. On October 2nd, 2023, I'm reconvening the Audit Committee meeting of the Board of the Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Okay, now, what are the action items we need to look at having come out of executive session? First is, I guess, back to number two. Is there a resolution to approve the audit firm or to recommend to the board? Does everyone see the resolution?
Mark Williams, so moved.
Motion by Mark. Is there a second? Chair seconds. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Did we lose Patty?
I'm checking right now.
No. She's unmuted herself. She's still there. But we can't hear her.
Okay. Then we also need to recommend a network penetration proposal to the board. And I think it, we're going to recommend proposer number D. Is that right?
Yes, it was a proposal from the company denoted by staff as D during the discussion.
Okay, could we insert that language in resolution 4.4.2?
I can't right now because it's an active PDF. And I can't do that while I'm in the middle of a Zoom.
But I think you can sort of make that amendment, make that now, and then you can change it afterwards, Bart.
If you want to make that motion with that language, I'll insert it and distribute it in the materials that will go to the board of directors.
Is there a motion to accept that?
Motion to accept the resolution indicating proposal D.
D as in dog?
D as in Delta. Yes, sir.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
We've got a motion by Mark and second by Patty. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Now, what other action item? We need to look at item or audit plan for the next year.
Oh, Dean, we have one more item from executive session. And this is on screen. It's the resolution dealing with the assessment receivables write-off.
Thank you. Okay, is there a motion to accept the write-offs?
So moved.
Motion by Patty.
Williams, second.
Second by Mark. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. Okay, now I think we're at item 8, aren't we?
Yes, we are at item 8.
Okay. The only adjustment to the audit plan is the penetration test.
Now, that was in the last year's audit plan, and since you've addressed it, there is nothing in the 2024 audit plan for network penetration testing.
Jarrett, you mentioned something about having the internal controls reviewed. Have we had that done?
The last one we did was when the one we mentioned in 2017, where we reviewed the internal controls for cash disbursements, receipts, and investments.
Yeah, I remember that.
I don't have anything in here for next year. If the committee wants to add something in April, we can always come back and revise the audit plan.
Well, maybe we had talked about the claims handling as we pick up more business, so to speak, to have the internal controls reviewed there. Is there any thoughts on that?
Well, I will add that staff is going to discuss having information for you to look at for consideration to be in your 2025 audit plan that will deal with the review of in-house claims adjudication and the review and funding for externally adjudicated claims. So you'll look at that later, and it'll be part of the audit plan for 2025. Should you choose to move forward with that.
I I'm sorry, Bart. I thought they were wanting to look at this for the next year's audit.
That would be year end 2024, which would be
But we don't have anything specifically in there because there's not been any decision made. But we can always come back and revise the audit plan when the committee reviews the scope of what they want to do next year. So that would fall. That would be in the fall.
Okay.
Audit committee functions. And so so what we would do is come back and revise this plan to add a piece in there, in which we've done that before. We revised the plan as needed.
So, Dean, let me ask you, if we put an item, a bullet in here for the fall 2024 audit committee functions or review the necessity for it's an engagement to review the in-house claims administration and the monitoring and funding of external claims administration. We could add that as a bullet now, or you could come back and add that in April.
Well, I think that's probably covered under the second and third bullets there under the false, you know, because you're looking at the expansion of the scope for the year end 2024. And you can also, in the second bullet, you're determining what type of audits you want to do.
Well, let's leave it to Dean and see if he wants it specifically noted.
Yeah, I think it's on the radar now, and I think we ought to put it in the plan. But what does everybody else think?
So, Dean, can I suggest something? Since we're looking at the 2024 audit plan, that audit plan is going to be ongoing all through, and you're going to be meeting again in April. We can add it to the plan, the 2024 audit plan in April, and just as a revision so we can get the language right and make sure it's specifically noted in a way that you're comfortable.
Well, and just also keep in mind, this is filed with the Texas Department of Insurance. And if you put it in the plan, then you're saying you're going to do that.
And I think April will give us time to really flesh out the increase. Because right now you're saying 20 to 30 checks a month. You know, not 100% sure things are going to be rolling good by then. But by April, we should have a handle on that, I would think.
So, Dean, would you be comfortable with that plan that we look at it in April for possible revision with some increased reporting from staff?
And I believe that's a standing agenda item. We always have that to go back and look at the audit plan to see if you want to change anything at the April meeting.
And that's fine. It's just so long as we don't drop it. And we do talk about April. I'm down to 9% battery, so
keep going. You're fine.
Need to move the plan as is.
Here's a proposed resolution on screen.
Here's our motion to accept the audit plan as is.
Williams, so moved.
Second.
Second by Patty. All those in favor, aye.
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 And the insurance review.
This will be quick. If I can just point out, if you want to go through the materials in your book, you will see very little change in the cost. Here's the business owner policy went up about $140. The commercial excess or umbrella policy, it's included in our other Hartford coverages. We don't pay for that. Our workers' comp went up by $9. Cyber liability went up by $338. And remember, last year we changed carriers when we tripled our amount of coverage. So we've got a very good rate there. There was absolutely no change in our financial institution bond for insurance companies. And there was a $1 decrease in our largest commercial coverage, our D&O policy. And the only thing I will add, Dean, I'm always asked, do I feel that we are adequate with these coverages? Yes, we do have adequate coverage, especially since we increased our cyber coverage last year. However, I do plan to shop the D&O policy a little broader next year. That's a pretty expensive policy. I want to see if we couldn't get a little better rate. And that's all I have on the commercial coverages, Dean.
Okay. Is that an action item?
No, sir. Just a report.
Okay. Okay, about the budget, is that next?
Yes, and this should really just be a written report. All this is Jarrett tells you here's what we're looking at and how we are developing the operating and capital expenditure budgets for 2024. There's nothing substantially different or anticipated. They're going to make these budgets increase incredibly. We have absolutely no planned capital expenditure. And Jarrett, just trying to be careful with Dean's battery, any anticipated bumps that I've not identified on the operating budget?
No, there's nothing there that is really going to bump up. But, you know, I just will caveat that with we cannot anticipate insolvency activity. So a lot of this is driven by insolvency activity. So that could happen.
And so, Dean, we will have the detailed budget for the January Board of Directors meeting. But we always like to say here, just put the assumptions on screen, what we're working with. Is there anything new that we didn't know about or didn't budget in previously? And there's not. So that's just a reporting item.
Okay. And then we need to look at our calendar.
Yes, sir.
Our next meeting is April the 9th.
That's the target. And of course, Dean, as we get closer and we can always adjust that, but that's the target. That leaves us a couple of weeks before the scheduled board meeting. So you can receive the audit, finalize it. And if there's any adjustments, we have time to make that made before distribution and review by the full board of directors. And that's all we have for today, Dean.
We may have lost Dean.
I do see that he's there, but.
Well, the iPhone is Patty.
Yeah, and I see the other Frigo, and he's.
Right, so that's the video. So he can see us.
So we've lost Dean. So in the absence of the chair, one of the other committee members like to step up and conclude the meeting. There are no other action items.
Do they have language?
Sure. They're about to have language.
Do you want to put it? I'm happy to do something if you want to put it on the screen.
I'm going to check and see if I have it right there real quick. Hang on.
And I apologize for all my technical difficulties.
We've had a few challenges today, but we're doing fine. Okay. Sorry, it takes me just a minute. I'm remote and I was not.
Oh, Frigo just said his phone died.
Yep. Sorry. Jarrett, we let him know that we're going to have one of the other members conclude the meeting. And you probably hear me feverishly clicking. I'm going as fast as I can. Mm-hmm. Okay. The last one here, if one of the committee members would like to adjourn the meeting.
This is Patty. I'm happy to adjourn the meeting. The time is 4:39 p.m. on October 2nd, and the meeting of the Audit Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been had pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.